right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Chris Hallam. I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. So that covers anything on the desktop operating system as well as the phone. Today we're going to be talking about the desktop, though. And we have some, I think, some pretty exciting stuff to tell you. The first thing I want to mention is thank you for coming. I'm really overwhelmed by the attendance that we have in this session. Typically, security gets a pretty nice group of people, but this is the largest group I've had in a security session for quite a while. So thank you. And maybe it's the title. I usually have just Windows Security Overview. This time I came up with a fancy name, and maybe the marketing worked. But at any rate, without further ado, let's go ahead and dive in. And so, as you all know, the world's changing. We've been talking about change every version of the OS. So it's almost a cliche. And of course, there's all sorts of opportunities with each OS that you can exploit. There's mobility, and there's a bunch of things up there on the board that I don't think are too familiar. But the thing that maybe you haven't thought about yet is your ability to exploit these scenarios very likely is hindered or compromised or will be prevented utterly because the landscape for security has gotten so bad. If we think about an analogy that we use all the time called the hockey stick, right? I think over time we've kind of had this evolution of threats at the bottom of the stick. And then the last few years we started to move up into a revolution, meaning that the threats, the ability of them to be successful, the sophistication has moved exponentially up the stick very, very quickly. And so we're really in the midst of a cyber revolution. And this is not marketing hype. This is just the reality. If you look at the big hacks that probably you and the audience have experienced or at least read about in the news, these are dramatic, spectacular attacks. Banking, every sector is involved. It's no longer, by the way, Fortune 500. It's really everyone. And so our view is there are people who are aware of the threats. And I think since you've attended this session, you're probably aware of some of these things. You've read about them. But I would guess that most of you are not prepared. You probably have big budgets and you do what you can, but it's block and tackle. And it's you're constantly kicking the bad guys out of your network very likely. And so there's these familiar threats, right? There's cybercrime, but now it's about massive, mass-scale cyber espionage. Warfare has been around for a while, but I think the thing that we're now worried about is cyber terror. The ability for a company to be taken down or a government to be attacked in a terrorist event. Imagine if your power grid was attacked by the black hats. Very scary things can happen. And as I mentioned earlier, it's no longer just Fortune 500 companies that are being attacked. It's every single company is being attacked. Anything that is vulnerable, no matter how insignificant, is very likely being attacked. Because everybody has something of interest, and everybody has something that can get them to a more interesting target. So if you look at the bottom of the stack, that bottom person at the bottom may give you information that helps you move up to the Fortune 500 where the greatest assets are. So everybody is being attacked at mass scale. And if you're living in the world of perimeter protection, it's too late for you. You need to move to assume breach, you have to protect every single resource. Every single file needs to be protected, right? You need multiple layers of access control around it. It's not just about using two-factor auth on your VPN to keep you secure. It has to be much, much more than that. And so you struggle with security, I'm assuming, just like all these people struggle. Look at all these names here, right? These are all names with giant security budgets for the most part. All of them have been hacked to some degree, in many cases and to spectacular effect. Look at the Bushehr nuclear facility. Perfect example of perimeter defense gone wrong, right? That's an air gap network, no wires going in, no wireless, and yet Stuxnet gets inside a nuclear facility. RSA, right? We've all had a lot of trust in RSA. It's a great company, right? But even they have a difficult time defending themselves. And so we could go on and on, but I think that we can all maybe insert our own organizations in this slot at some degree. And so it's time for a change. And so the way our attackers are getting in, there's lots of different attacks. I think the old world used to be vulnerabilities on servers, sitting on the edge of the network, getting us inside, and we got pretty good about defending that. But now it's really the clients. The clients are the gateway into most organizations. And so attackers are going after them. And it's not just Windows devices. It could be any device, iOS, Android. Anything that can get you access to a client and maybe the user's identity is going to give you a pathway into the organization. And once you're in, you very likely are going to be able to spread yourself out within it. If you're familiar with pass-a-hash attacks, Kerberos ticket-type pass-a-hash type attacks, you'll know that once somebody gets that one endpoint, that they can access many more. And if they access a IT endpoint, very likely they can access some very sensitive servers. I talked to a company just about a month ago that talked about how a pass the hash attack was used to get access to the certificate authority on their network. And you can only imagine what a problem they had once that occurred. Imagine trying to get rid of that attacker once they had all of these hashes and that high-level privilege. So Windows 10 very much so is about limiting some of the worst attacks. And unlike, I think, what we've done in previous versions of Windows, where we've incrementally made it harder for attackers by adding more defense in depth. Like, we talk about defense in depth all the time, but we very rarely talk about architectural solutions that eliminate, to the extent that we can eliminate anything in the security world. But instead of talking about incremental improvements in defense in depth, we're talking about architectural solutions that maybe eliminate the risk factors that we're used to. And so that's really what Windows 10 is about in many cases. It's delivering not just incremental improvements, but decisive architectural changes that eliminate some of the attacks that we're used to. And so, of course, we're organized around the same pillars we always have: securing identities, information protection, and threat resistance. And we'll talk about new technology and each of those. And before I get into the details here, there's actually a much broader story that we're going to tell throughout this year and next year. There is so much going on in security, I would need maybe two or three overview sessions to really cover it. There's so much we can talk about. But we're going to be talking about the big ticket items, the big ones that the press are going to be talking about and you'll remember most because they're so, I think, impressive in many ways. And so with the first thing, we're going to talk about identity. And so Windows 10 will usher in the end of passwords. And I want to be very clear. People have been talking about getting rid of passwords for the longest time, right? Every year somebody says, oh, the end of passwords is here. And maybe that's true if you implement that one solution. But have you implemented that solution? Probably not. And the reason why is it's too expensive, too complex, too much friction for your end users, and we could kind of go on and on and on, right? But the reality is the solutions we have today, whether they're smart cards or RSA tokens or any of the other options, they're just not right for scale. And so what I find is when I talk to most organizations, they're using smart cards and two-factor auth on their VPN, because you want to prevent remote access with usernames and passwords. You want a second factor. But they're not using that to protect resources on the network. So that's a huge gap. And it's because it's too expensive to use these, and there's too much friction for users. And so when we move to Threshold, or Windows 10, as we're calling it, we have a solution that's going to work for consumers, and it's going to work for enterprises. It's going to be easy to deploy. And we believe the stage is set for you to adopt this technology and roll it out and into single factor auth in your organization. So before we talk about the technology, just for those of you who are maybe not familiar with how bad passwords are or why we need to move away from them, well, here's one reason. There's one organization that has 1.2 billion username and password combinations. Now, that's probably exaggerated because this was reported by the hacker group themselves, but my guess is they probably have a lot of these things. In fact, it's interesting that something that coincided with this event, if you follow the press, is they released this announcement, and within weeks, some very high-profile celebrities had their accounts breached on the iCloud. Now, that was not because, based on the information I have, because somebody found a vulnerability in the iCloud. My theory, this is just my personal theory, is that maybe these passwords, which are for sale, were accessed by these attackers, and maybe those happen to be celebrity accounts. Just theorizing here, but I think because there's 1.8 billion users online, and this group says they have 1.2 billion passwords, chances are some of our own passwords are in that group, don't you think? So anyway, so this gives you just some perspective. Another thing I think is interesting here is on the right. They access these from 420,000 websites. So it wasn't like they breached eBay or some high-profile website and got massive amounts. Maybe that's part of that group, too. My guess is they actually went after some very, very small websites that sell batteries or very toys or anything. And these websites typically don't have the security budget that Lockheed Martin or your bank has to protect the database that stores the username and password. So they're going after very small targets and harvesting lots and lots of accounts. And because 75% of our users maybe not this group here because you care about security, but 75% of the world uses as often as possible the same password on every single website they go to. So if you breach the flower shop and get a username and password, you probably have the password to somebody's bank. So it's a big problem. Target is a perfect example of how bad passwords are. Now, if you're familiar with the Target case, which happened almost over a year ago, it's fairly old news. But what's interesting about this is Target issued a username and password to a third party, a party that serviced their air conditioning systems remotely, and gave them a username and password and enabled them to connect to their network remotely with a single factor of authentication. And so this username and password fell into the wrong hands, and they remotely accessed this network, and then they put malware on their POS systems and stole tens of millions of credit cards. And, of course, this was repeated at another big American company called Home Depot. I'm not sure how familiar this name is to you, but this is one of the largest home repair hardware stores in the nation, the United States. It's gigantic. Probably leading. I think there is even an international presence here, but this is one of the biggest retailers in the United States. And then you can insert the name here because this tool, I forget what it's called. I think it's called Block ID or something like that. I forget the name of the malware. It's being used again and again and again. Neiman Marcus and a bunch of other big high-profile retailers are being hit with this. So we have a solution for the malware side of this, but we also have a great solution for identity, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. And so what exactly is wrong with these passwords? Well, we talked about one reason. They're bad because they're single factor. The other thing that is bad about them is they're shared secrets. It's a secret that I can share to a friend. So if you're familiar with the Edward Snowden case, one of his coworkers shared their password with him. And what a big mistake that turned out to be, right? So these are things that are shared. They're also phished, right? We have phishing attacks on Microsoft, and you have them on your own companies, I'm sure, where people set up a website that looks just like your website, and boom, there's a pop-up asking for my username and password. Savvy people typically don't enter in their credentials there, but most people are not savvy, and they do. So phishing attacks are being used, and so you can be phished very easily, and they're doing that quite a bit. Also, on the data center side, your password can be breached. And what I mean by that is if you're able to compromise the data store that has the username and password, you can very likely get the username and password. Now, that's not so easy to do with Active Directory. We protect that identity in a way that makes it very difficult for a data center breach to result in your identity be compromised. But there are some ways to do it kind of indirectly. But these little websites we talked about, the little flower shop, they're not using that type of technology because they can't afford it. So it's easily breached in all sorts of different directions. And so here's a slide that kind of think expresses what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, what's happening. And so the weakest link is these websites frequently, and the most weak link is the one at the bottom, the obscure website.com, the flower shop. And so the attacker, if they want to get your bank, they don't go after the bank directly, although maybe they do, they're just going to go after that tiny little website, get your username and password, and they're going to pray that you're part of the 75% that uses the same password everywhere. And, of course, now they've got access to everything. So this is happening at massive scale, we just have to move as quickly as possible away from this. Now, what about corporate accounts? Corporate accounts are a little bit more secure, but there's some attack vectors even you need to think about. So if we're thinking about your Active Directory account, for instance, right, it's very hard to breach that in the data center, but there are two ways you can breach it. Right? One is the user, Edward Snowden attack, right? Just, hey, Joe, give me your password. I need to access this server and my password's not working or whatever. But here's something that people are not thinking enough about, which is the device itself. And this is applicable to servers and it's applicable to endpoints. If you're not encrypting these drives, if you're not using BitLocker or third-party encryption, there are tools that allow you or a bad guy to extract the domain name, the username, and the password for that user right out of the LSA store. Right? So there are hacker tools out there. If you're not encrypting that drive and preventing physical access to that store through encryption, you're vulnerable to this attack. So if you're not disposing your drive securely, if you're even at the server level, these things are at risk. So you need to be very careful. You should be encrypting every PC, not just your laptops that are mobile. That's a good place to start, but you have to move it all the way into the data center, all devices. So without further ado, let's talk about the solution, because, of course, that's what you're really here, not so much the pitch. And so We have some more slides. I'll give a little more detail. But the high-level pitch of the solution is we have a two-factor authentication solution that is inherently two factors. It's a solution that Windows generates itself. You don't need to bring another physical device or bring a bunch of additional infrastructure into your environment necessarily. This is something that Windows all by itself can build. And the way we're doing it is we're going to take the device itself, your PC that you're using right now, many of you, that will become the second factor. Your first factor will be a PIN. So it's not going to be a password, it's going to be a PIN. And this PIN can be alpha or numeric, we don't care. But we're moving away from the semantics. The phrase password it's a bad word now. And so we need to move the semantics to something new. A PIN to most people represents something associated with something physical, like a debit card or a credit card. So I think moving the terms to PIN is a good way to go, even though a PIN in isolation is just like a password. But what makes a PIN in this case better is your PC will become the second factor. Unlike a smart card, you're going to be able to use a biometric option with this physical device. So if you're familiar with virtual smart cards, which were released in Windows 8 and 8.1, you'll remember that you could push a certificate down to the device, and you could get access to it via a PIN. Just like a physical smart card, but now your PC is the virtual smart card. So this is that technology was really the precursor to this one. So it's very much like a physical smart card, but now you can use a biometric option. Fingerprint, iris, facial, all these different options are out there. Windows will ship fingerprint technology in the box. So if you want to use iris or facial, you're going to have to get third-party middleware. But it will work with the solution. So Dell and HP, a lot of these companies and many others have facial recognition options out there that are considered secure in some with some people. And so be able to use this with this new credential technology. Incidentally, you're probably wondering, well, why hasn't he given it a name yet? And so the name that we use internally, so if you're tweeting anything out there, this is an internal name, right, is Next Generation Credential. You'll find that running in Service Control Manager. And that is the system component that's managing this new identity type. We will come up with a proper name after we go through the branding exercise. But for now, we'll refer to it as NGC or Next Generation Credential. But that is going to be a temporary name. Because this technology, one other option. So I mentioned that your PC can be one factor, but here's something that's even better. My phone can be the other factor as well. Who went to the keynote this morning with Joe and saw the demo? Okay. All right, so it's a pretty cool demo. Something that he wasn't able to show you, actually, which is too bad because we're early in the product cycle, is what Joe showed is he walked up to his PC. So imagine I got my PC here, and I bring my phone here in proximity of my PC. Joe has showed everybody that I can type in a PIN here and unlock my PC. But that's not convenient, right? But that's what's ready in the build that he had available. What I want to do is keep my phone in my pocket, and I want to walk up to my PC and type my PIN and unlock it. That's what we'll be shipping with this release. So it's going to be much better than the demo you showed. And I don't think Joe mentioned that during the demo because he was talking at about a million miles an hour during that, of course. But the point is you'll be able to use your phone as a device as the second factor. This will be true not just on Windows Phone. It will work on iOS, and it will also work on Android. With Windows Phone, it's going to be very, very secure. We're using the TPM to protect this credential, so it can never be extracted or removed in an unencrypted form. Technically, if you got physical access to memory, you could maybe extract the content, but it would be encrypted, and it would never be able to, unless you can crack the encryption, you would never get access to the actual credential. So very secure there. In the case of iOS, it sits inside of a container. And that's, I think, an effective thing. They have secure boot chain, and I think that's also a very secure. With Android's a little bit of a different story. As many of you, I see every, a lot of people went, it's as secure as Androids can be. I think there's a lot of challenges there. So, anyway, there are ways to make Android more secure and less secure. But most of the users, I think, are using Android in a way where it creates some risks. And in the risk factor, just, I know I'm going a little tangent. What's the big risk factor with Android? Android's a pretty good OS. The problem is they're allowing people to get applications from untrusted sources, and that's causing a big malware challenge there. They have the technology. In fact, they have their own store. If they were to limit distribution of applications through a trusted store, I think they could eliminate a lot of the challenges. But they haven't done that yet. So I see Android having some of the similar challenges that we've had on PCs traditionally. There was a question, I think, that went up there for a minute. Let me take that now.
Can you repeat?
Yeah, so the question is, will I be able to use this next generation credential on a BlackBerry device? At this point, we're considering it. It's not part of the product plan at this moment, but based on demand, that's something that we would respond to reactively. At this point, we haven't seen enough asks, but the more people who ask for it, higher up it moves up our priority list. So let's see here. So that pretty much covers kind of what the next generation credential is. Two-factor, I can use my phone or multiple platforms as effectively a mobile smart card-like device. So this is a pretty good solution. Now, let's talk about PKI. Because that's probably a lot of you are going, oh, well, how does this work with PKI? Well, it's going to actually work really, really well. So PKI is the familiar way of dealing with two-factor. And so in that case here, a user is going to prove their identity and they're going to receive a certificate. Certificate's going to be on the PC, hopefully protected using Windows 8.1 APIs to bind it to the PC using the TPM or not, but it can be either one of those ways. So that's a familiar way of handling identity. And so with Windows 10, and of course, in that case, they would use maybe a PIN if they're using a virtual smart card or unlock with a password, which would give them access to the certificate. So you're going to be able to use PKI with this next generation credential technology. And what's going to happen is Windows is going to just handle all the magic on its own. You still deploy a certificate to the PC, just like we showed. But what's going to happen is that certificate in this case, which is going to be used for your identity, is going to be put inside of a container. And so that container is protected by the TPM, of course, and the user gains access to the container when they provide their PIN or their biometric identity. So that's what unlocks access to the container, gives us access to the certificate, and then we can then use that for authentication. So it's very, very similar, right? So I unlock it. Hey, I have my certificate. Give me a token. Okay, here's your access token because I trust you, and now I can get access to the network. So from your perspective, what's different is really only this one thing, is the fact that the certificate that gets provisioned using your infrastructure that you already have today is going to be put inside a different container by Windows, and it's just going to work. And so it's a little bit more complicated than that. I'm kind of simplifying it. But the point is that you don't need to redesign PKI to adopt this technology. The goal is this has to be easy for you to adopt. It has to be something that can even work alongside other options. Like if you have smart cards out in your environment, you should be able to easily roll to this or use them together. Right? It doesn't have to be one or the other. So let's talk about the new approach. And this one, to me, is super exciting. The PKI thing is a requirement. We have to do that, obviously. But this is where I think things get really interesting. So the new approach is what we call key-based. So there's keys in the other solution, obviously, but this is a key without a certificate. And so where do these keys come from? Well, when I create a new account, let's imagine I go to Amazon.com and I'm creating a new account. I've already proven who I am because I'm creating a new account. It's mine. I provide my name, etc. And what will happen is Amazon would say, hey, I need a key, right? What are you going to use for your identity? And the client, in this case, is going to send up their public key that Windows is going to create to Amazon, and Amazon would map that to the account. And so Amazon has a relationship between the user's account and this public key, and now we're going to be able to do an exchange there and prove who our identity is using that. Now, if I've already have an account, well, how do I switch over from a password to this new type of mode? Well, that'll be up for Amazon to decide how to bootstrap that process, but it will be a way using our APIs for you to transition from the password and have Amazon say, let's create this new next generation credential and let's use that instead moving forward. So there'll be a way, and that's really up for the vendor to do. But at any rate, once you have it, of course, you then authenticate using you'll sign something using the private key. You'll send it up to the server, and the server will use the algorithm and say, yeah, the public key I have and this data that I just received is signed. Yep, we know that those are the same, and now we're going to authenticate you. We trust that you're you. And then the rest of it works just like you'd expect. You get an access token, and you access the website. So key-based solution is really great, right? Because guess what? This means that we can do this for consumers. Right? There's no PKI infrastructure that doesn't scale to the consumer scenarios. Now Amazon and Facebook and all these other websites out there will be able to adopt this type of approach, and everybody can move to two-factor as a result. So it's a very interesting solution. And so what's different? The different things, of course, are the unlock mechanism and then the way that we're sending up the public key and the way we do the transaction there. So why is this solution going to work well, right? If it was just a Microsoft solution and it was proprietary, how would it be adopted on the web? Well, it very likely wouldn't. So Microsoft is working along with some very interesting names, one of which I think is Google, which I think is a very interesting partner. We are co-board members on the FIDO Alliance. FIDO Alliance is working towards a standard that will allow us to rid the world of passwords. And so Google released a technology last week. You probably saw the press. I think it's called Secure Key, maybe, where you put your key on this USB attached device, and I think it maybe can be on other types of devices. This solution is something we're working with FIDO on to make sure that it meets all the specifications. So we're still in the process of getting that all vetted and getting feedback. But the end goal is that it will be FIDO compliant. That's something we're working on, to be very clear, right? We're a board member, but we still have process to go through to say that our solution meets all of the FIDO requirements. But in the end, it will succeed. I know we'll succeed because there's lots of support for this. But the thing that's interesting about our solution, I think, versus Google, Google's solution was, well, you need to bring another factor to the experience, a factor that I maybe don't want to actually carry, right? I don't want to add a key fob to my keychain, or, you know, wouldn't it be great if my PC could be the key factor or my phone, right? This is something we're always carrying with us. Now, I think there's room in the world for both. But I like the convenience factor that we have here, and it's something that we haven't seen yet by those others like Google at this point. So let's switch to a new topic. So the first topic was, like, how do we secure the user's identity so that when they're authenticated, that we know that they're themselves, and we use two-factor for that. Well, there's another problem with identity, which is related to an attack we call the pass-a-hash attack, pass-the-ticket attack, and there's all sorts of different names for this. And so once you authenticate, if you remember the slide I just showed you, you receive an access token. And so the access token is what you use as you touch all the servers on the network. And because you have this token, you don't have to re-authenticate every time you transition to a new location. Well, these tickets are your identity in effect, right? It doesn't have your username and password, but it gives you somebody your access. And so attackers have become very, very adept at stealing these attacks or these tickets and these hashes. And we call that a pass-a-hash attack. They steal the hash, and then they access another server with it as your with your credentials. And so it's a very difficult attack once it's happened, too, because we no longer have a user signing in and creating audit record. They have this ticket, and they're just walking around, and so accessing other servers. So it's very difficult to identify when this is happening. There's lots of tools out there, but they're expensive. It requires a high level of sophistication. But once this attack starts, it's very difficult. If you get the hash, for instance, of an IT professional who has access to many servers, imagine what happens if you access one of those servers. Guess what? I probably have the tickets and the hashes for other IT professionals. And so what happens is usually the access to one ticket or one hash gives the attacker to get access to many, many more. And for this reason, what we see is they transition from one ticket to another ticket to another ticket, and then IT finds out, oh my gosh, we have a pass-a-hash attack app, and shut down that one. So they shut down that one, but they're already on to the next one. So it's this vicious cycle of whack-a-mole, if you're familiar with the whack-a-mole analogy. But at any rate, in Windows 7 and Windows 8.1, we have a mitigation that makes it hard to get these tokens. But it's not an architectural solution that eliminates a possibility that they could be accessed. It just makes it a lot harder. And while it's pretty effective on 7 and 8.1, it's not effective enough. And so in order to solve this problem in its entirety, we have to provide an architectural solution. And so the architectural solution comes by way of this thing that it's basically a new container technology. And the container is basically what we call virtual secure mode. And so what happens is we're going to spin up what effectively is a mini VM. Not a big VM with all of Windows, so don't think about it in those terms. Think of it as a min-core Windows VM supported with hardware and Hyper-V behind it. So meaning I have another operating system running in parallel with Windows. That Hyper-V container is running the LSA service. So if you're familiar with authentication, you know the LSA service is what is basically a broker of authentication. It's what has access to your access tokens and all these things. So it does all the authentication. So now it's running in an isolated container that is physically separate from the OS. And because of that, even in the event of a kernel-level exploit that gives an attacker system access with all access, full access to the kernel and everything else, it actually doesn't have access to the container. So it's completely isolated. So we now have a situation where malware, even the most sophisticated malware with the highest level of privilege, will never be able to gain access to these tokens and these tickets. They cannot be extracted from the container, period. Now, if there's a vulnerability in our architecture of VSM, there may be a pathway to getting this information. But this is very different than a defense. It's an architectural solution that clearly separates the components. So this will be extremely effective, but we can never promise that a pass-a-hash attack can never happen because of this. But I think what you're going to see is it's going to drop very quickly to hopefully zero. All right, let's move on to a new topic. So I hope we've made a good case for the passwords, moving away from passwords. It works for consumers. It works for enterprises. And hopefully you're excited about that technology, because this is one of the most exciting features for me, because identity is actually my passion on security. But let's talk about a new topic, which actually might actually maybe even be more interesting to most of you, to be honest. And that's related to information protection. So we've had a pretty good set of information protection technologies for a while. We have BitLocker, and BitLocker is a solution over here. It protects data when the data is on the PC. But when the PC is moved, or the data is moved off of the PC, it's no longer protected. And why is that? It's because we protect the volume with a container. We don't protect the files. So it's only good when the data is on the disk. So as soon as it leaves, it's exposed and unencrypted. On the other end of the spectrum over here, we have rights management services. So if you're familiar with RMS and Office IRM, you know that you can add file level protection to files, and you can share those internally with a limited set of users, or you can share them B2B or B2C outside of your organization, and you'll have persistent data protection and rights management on top of it. So the user who receives it can't print it, can't copy paste from it, and so that's an effective solution. But the problem with RMS is the way you're deploying it today is it's an opt-in thing. Your users typically have to make a choice. I have some content. I want to protect it when I send it to this user, and they go take a specific action to do it. It doesn't have to be that way, but that's the way most people do it. The solution that we want to deliver is in the middle. We want to provide a solution that helps prevent accidental data leakage. So we're not promising, hey, the end of leaking of data on Windows. That's not the solution we're talking about here, but we're going to help prevent data leakage through accidental purposes, which is, of course, what happens most often. And so let's talk about how often our data is leaking. Today, people in this room, are maybe in the senior space or the manager space. 87% of you, based on the statistic, send mail to your personal accounts. You put it up to the cloud that's not a business cloud. And why do you do it? Do you do it because you're a bad person? No. Do you break company policy? Probably, but why do you do it? You do it because you just want to get your job done, right? And things get in our way, right? I remember just a couple weeks ago, there was a server that I needed to access so I could share content securely, and because it was down, I used an insecure way of getting it to that person. I just had to trust that it was going to work, and I'm sure that it did, but we'll never really know. But at any rate, so 87% of you are doing that. 58% of us, and I think it's actually 100%, I don't know how anybody could avoid this, accidentally send something to the wrong person. It happens all the time. My coworkers constantly are accidentally sending email to my Hotmail account. And it's because my coworkers are friends of mine, and they're also coworkers. And so they know my Hotmail account, etc. Sometimes I receive email from the wrong person altogether. Oh, I meant to send that to you, Chris. In fact, one of the analyst firms out there, one of the big three, so Gartner, Forrester, or IDC, sent me an internal confidential mail related to a review that we were doing with them, and it had some very internal comments about our feedback to them. Now, it wasn't a big deal, but that was not a conversation they wanted us to have exposure to. And so this kind of stuff happens quite often. And so we want to help prevent that. And so the solutions that you have today are one of two. One solution is on mobile. Knox is an example. Good technologies on mobile, AirWatch containers, and we could kind of go on and on and on. And those solutions are pretty effective. They keep data inside a container. That container may just contain one app, like Good, or maybe it contains a bunch of apps, like Samsung Knox. The trouble with these solutions is it always requires a user to do something that they don't normally do on their PCs to deal with this protected content. I have to switch modes in Knox to work securely. If I want to access corporate email on my iPhone or my Windows phone, I need to go into good because the native default email client can't keep my data secure in the way that I want. And so I have to stop using the tools that I want to use, and I have to use tools that oftentimes aren't as good as Office and some of the other things. And so that's on one side of the spectrum on mobile. On the desktop, we have solutions like Symantec, file encryption, McAfee, RSA, DLP. There's a bunch of DLP solutions out there, but when I talk to most customers, and I'm going to take a poll in a minute here, most customers do not deploy DLP like those solutions on their desktops because it creates too much friction and it's too expensive. And so you know, I'm from the U.S., and the U.S. has different habits than Europe, and I'd love to just get a quick raise of hands. Who's using, on the desktop, a DLP solution like RSA DLP or Symantec DLP? Not disk encryption, but an actual true DLP solution on all your devices. Okay, so, like, I barely can find two people right now. Maybe there's three or four, I can't tell, but almost nobody does it. And so with our solution, we're going to give you a solution on the desktop. It also works on mobile. It works the same way. And you're going to be able to get a level of protection that you've probably never been able to deploy on your desktops. And so what we're going to do that's very different than the solutions you see on mobile, which most people are familiar with, is rather than creating a container that all data sits in and separating our personal data and our corporate data by literally having separate containers for these things, we're going to put a container around every single file. So every file sits in its own container. Every app sits inside its own container. And we use Windows as an access control broker to help ensure that a corporate app has access to corporate data, but non-corporate apps do not have access to corporate data. And so you have policies you can set, and you can be very rigid with those, or you can be very open. You may want public apps that are not corporate to have access to your data. That's your choice to make. But we'll give you policies that allow you to lock that down as tight as you want or be as open as you want. And because it's baked into the platform itself, guess what? I don't have any of the friction that I'm used to with RSA, DLP, or Samsung Knox. I don't have to switch modes. I don't have to go into a special place or a special app to do my work. I can use Outlook and use my desktop and save my files anywhere I want, and it doesn't matter. Windows knows what's corporate. Windows knows what's personal. And it just works. And so this all happens under this hood. And I have a session on, it's either tomorrow or Thursday, I'd have to check, and where we talk about this in more detail, because this is a pretty complex topic, obviously. But it's a very robust solution, but directed at accidental data leakage. Question?
Is there also protection or separation of device memory?
Yeah, so the question is, does this solution also provide memory-level protection that would prevent maybe malware that's gaining high privilege to access protected content? So we can't eliminate the possibility of malware getting access to corporate content with this solution. We can provide some pretty good assurances, though. With some of the other mitigations, which we'll talk about a little bit at the end of the presentation, we'll make it a lot harder for malware to even run on the PC, but this is not an utter way of preventing a purpose-built application to get access to corporate data. So in other words, if somebody builds malware specifically to defeat this system, somebody could be able to do that. And I think that raises the bar maybe to the upper echelon of attackers. General-purpose malware targeted at consumers would be access denied. So I think about it as high-end malware, purpose-built, designed to defeat the system, can probably get access. Average malware will have access denied to corporate data. Futuristically, I think we can close that off, but with this particular release, we can't provide malware. We can provide malware resistance, but not malware protection, if you get the distinction. This solution, it works on Windows Mobile and also on Windows Desktop. It works in the same way. It's all built behind the scenes and transparent to the user. It will also work cross-platform. It will work on iOS. It will work on Android. It will work on OS X. The We can't integrate deeply into those systems, so the experience will be a little more like Samsung Knox and AirWatch containers. So there'll be a little more of context switching for the users, but the data will be accessible and usable on those platforms. And in the case of Office, actually, it will be very transparent. So in other words, if I send protected content from a Windows PC and it ends up on an iPad, for instance, running the iPad Office Edition, or Office Edition for iPad, it would be very seamless to the user. They would open up files and not realize it was protected, yet it would have all that protection behind the scenes. So the way the data protection lifecycle works, and we'll talk about this in more detail later, so I'm just going to move very quickly, is you have an active enrollment. So I need to get keys from somewhere, because the keys are used for protecting it. So you'll be able to get keys from your MDM or SCCM. So that's the way the keys will get sent. Content gets protected on ingress. So when data comes to the PC, we'll know if it's coming from a corporate location or from a public location. So data coming in will be protected automatically. Data genesis is where I create new data. And when I create new data, who knows if it's personal or corporate? We have UI elements that allow the user to say, this is mine or this is my corporation's. Data egress, I skipped ahead by accident. With data egress, so we can protect the content as it moves into the cloud if the application that syncs it to the cloud uses our API. So anything that moves the data off the box has a potential to strip encryption. And as long as they're using our API, and we're working with Box and all the cloud storage providers to embrace the API, as long as they use the API, we can protect it when it leaves the device. Alternatively, you can use RMS. So RMS and this solution work hand-in-hand. EDP, or Enterprise Data Protection, is about protecting the data kind of automatically, but it's not about sharing. It could be about sharing within my organization, but it's sharing to everybody. If I want to limit who has access to the content in my org, or if I want to share it outside of my org, that's where RMS is focused. So if you're familiar with RMS, think about that as more of a sharing capability, and the encryption part of it is really kind of part of the platform itself moving forward. And of course, we have the ability to wipe the data as well. So when you unenroll or you want to whack the data because, let's say, an employee is terminated, we can automatically go and find all the corporate data and physically remove it off the device. So first thing we do is delete the keys. Next thing we do is, on a slow back-end process, start deleting the files. But remember, even though it takes some time for that to happen, once the key's gone, there's no access to the content. So we clean up the data kind of behind the scenes over time, but control access right away. All right, so I think we've got a great solution. It really, I think, fills in the gap. You know, we've got BitLocker, we've got RMS, now we got something in the middle that's very effective. And we're very committed to information protection, and there's a lot of things we can do down the road to make it even better and maybe address the malware concerns we talked about. Maybe we can focus beyond just accidental data leakage. Maybe we can focus more even on intentful data leakage, although we should always assume that an evil admin on a PC will always be able to defeat any processes you have. But let's move to the last area, and then looks like we'll have plenty of time for questions, actually, which is great. So we believe that we're really going to take malware to task with this release. We had some pretty good things in Windows 8.1. I was super excited about what we did at the time because it just felt like we were really solving some big problems. With UEFI and TPM in combination, we were able to pretty much say that bootkits and rootkits on Windows are gone. Not all of them. There's still some ways of it happening, but I think that, like, is a percentage we eliminated most of the risk factors for those type of things. And, of course, those are the worst ones, right? Those are the things that get under Windows and hide from Windows and your defenses. So I think we've done great work there. But we have a couple solutions that are going to be a little bit more decisive. And so let's talk about those. The first thing is related to isolation architecture. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But we're really working on re-engineering the operating system to isolate its components, right? It used to be kind of one big operating system, and if you gained kernel-level, system-level access, you had access to everything. We're systematically going through and making sure that that's no longer always the case, right? So we're really narrowing the surface area of attack. The next thing we're going to do is, I think, eliminate malware on PCs for certain types of PCs. And so I want to underline certain. Not every PC in the world will be able to adopt this technology, but if you buy specific devices from your OEMs, you'll be able to probably eliminate most forms of malware that we experience today. So I'm talking about 99.99%, maybe 98, I don't know what the number will be, but you'll get the point when we get there. So this is really game-changing what we're talking about. So let's talk about the the isolation architecture first. So we talked about this a little bit in the context of the pass-a-hash attacks, right? In order to prevent pass-a-hash, we have to isolate these access tokens in a special container. And so I talked about virtual secure mode in the context of identity, but actually it's going to be very useful for a broader range of scenarios, some of which, if anybody's attending Jeffrey Snover's sessions, I think he's going to be talking about this in terms of servers. So there's a lot more than I'll be able to tell, but because I'm not a server guy, but they're using VSM technology over there. But there's two other scenarios that we're talking about, at least today, and maybe more later in the product cycle, where VSM technology is going to help us. Number one is we're going to also be able to take a feature called the code integrity service. So if you're familiar with Trusted Boot in Windows 8.1, Trusted Boot prevents bootkits from injecting themselves into the boot process after Windows has started. So bootkits are things that start before Windows. Rootkits are things that start as Windows is starting up. What we're going to be able to do is we're going to take the code integrity service, which can still be compromised in 8.1, and we're going to put it in a VSM. So now, guess what? Somebody accesses a kernel and has full system access, they can't turn off code integrity, which means that they can't install malicious drivers that can start, et cetera, which we see with malware like Allurian and all the other things that try to bypass system defenses by turning them off. So we're putting what we call the hypervisor code integrity service inside the VSM. So that's one scenario. And hypervisor code integrity will make more sense on the next slide that I get to. The other thing is pretty cool, which is virtual TPM. So let me disambiguate what that means. So we have discrete TPMs, which are physical chips on motherboards. We have firmware TPM, which is TPM that is firmware-based that can be put inside of Trust Zone or Intel's platform trust technology. So if you're familiar with SOC chips, they have this special security component. We can put firmware TPM in there. So it's pretty much, it's almost like discrete, but technically not. We have a third TPM option called virtual TPM. And so what we will do is we will spin up a VSM, and we will put a virtual TPM inside of it. And we will use this really not for consumer side scenarios. So it's really not a desktop feature, but it's really nice for server. So if I'm running VMs, and I want to run a client side VM, our story today is, well, we can't protect your secrets with TPM, right? So let's hope that your server's secure. Well, now that we have virtual TPM, your client VMs running on servers will be able to take advantage of a virtual TPM that is, in theory, is just as secure as the other two options I've mentioned. So this solution requires a special server role. So the server edition that aligns with Windows 10 will have the server role you need to manage these TPMs. Because they're virtual, they clearly need to be managed so they can be turned on and off, etc. And so we'll have a server role to manage that. All right, so the next thing that we're going to do is related to Windows defenses themselves. So we are isolating many of the Windows defenses we have, like the firewall and Windows Defender and some of the other things that we can name, away from applications. And the way we're doing that is we have this concept that we had in 8.1 called protected processes. And what a protected process is a process who can only be contacted or communicated by with another process that is signed by Microsoft. So today what happens is malware gets on the PC, it may be signed by VeriSign, it may not, and it may be able to inject stuff into the kernel or other services. Because Windows Defender can't be tampered with without a protected process, that means that malware can't turn off Windows Defender in theory. And so Windows Firewall, Defender, and all these other components are protected with this. So malware shouldn't have the ability, but we can never promise this. The typical bypasses, I think we've eliminated. So Windows defenses should be very, very resilient compared to the way they are today. Now, Windows Defender has a couple changes that we're making as well. And the way to tee up this story is what's happening with people's devices in the consumer space in particular. When you buy a brand new PC, it almost certainly comes with a version of McAfee or Symantec, or it could even come with Windows Defender. And that's usually a trial basis subscription solution. At the end of the subscription, guess what? It stops working, right? And so you're no longer protected. And we have telemetry data showing us how many people are unprotected because they have expired third-party software. And the number is not above 10%, but it's pretty close to it. It's pretty scary. So that's a large percentage of PCs running no anti-malware solution at all. And so this is a big problem. So what we're going to do with Windows 10 is we're going to create the condition. So in the event that third-party anti-malware solution expires and stays expired for 3 days, we will turn on Windows Defender. Done. So you have a three-day window, which is longer than we'd like, but we'll turn it on. I'd like it to be zero. Our third-party anti-malware vendors don't want it to be zero. So there's some challenges you can imagine. And so we go to great lengths to keep them happy. We go to great lengths to try to get the user to actually resubscribe to the third-party anti-malware solution. Because to be honest, we don't make money on Windows Defender. We only put it in there because a lot of people are not willing to pay for it. We got to protect our users. So we do it because we have to. If they want to use McAfee or Symantec AV, we're just as happy. It doesn't really matter. When we get into the enterprise side, we actually do care because we have a product called SCEP, System Center Endpoint Protection, and then we do care. But I think on the consumer side, run whatever you want. We're just as happy. Something else we've done is what happens when you get a low-level rootkit. So let's imagine I've got a Windows 7 PC that doesn't have UEFI and secure boot and the boot protection. So I can't provide boot and rootkit protection because I don't have the hardware I need to do it. Right? There's hundreds of millions of devices in this case. Those devices will get potentially a boot or rootkit on them, and Windows won't know it's there, but eventually somebody's going to find out something's wrong on this PC. Well, what do you do in that case? Well, typically you boot to a clean environment. So you take a USB drive with an offline AV scanner, you boot to the USB scanner, scan the drive, you find the malware, you clean it, you reboot. Well, who here has tried to use Windows Defender offline on a Windows 8 generation PC or greater? So a few of you. Well, I've tried to do it on two different PCs, and it doesn't work on either of my PCs, and here's why. We don't include the drivers for RAID arrays on there. So if your disk is connected to RAID, we can't load the driver, and so guess what? A lot of PCs have RAID disk configurations now, and so we only work on what I think is increasingly legacy devices. So we could fix that problem, but what we decided to do is make the experience better. What we're doing is we're taking Windows Defender offline and we're putting it inside Windows RE. And so now you actually have Windows Defender offline in a secure, isolated recovery environment. So even if Windows is completely rooted, hopefully RE is not tampered with, and we've got all sorts of defenses to hopefully we can make that promise. And now you can boot right into a clean environment, rescan the PC, and you're off to the races and clean. Question? Yeah, so during Windows recovery environment, we'll boot enough networking capability to get to Windows Update to download the latest signatures. So,
that's
yes?
While your PC is still functioning, you're getting antivirus updates.
Yes.
These are applied to the PC, but are they also applied to the one that's in your recovery environment?
That
reboot without network capability?
I actually don't know the answer. So the question is, so you know you're going to get updates when you're running on the desktop, right? That's how it always worked. The question is, what happens when I go into the recovery environment? Does the recovery environment already have the latest signatures? I want to say the answer is yes, but I don't know 100% for sure. There was some conversation about this, and I failed to digest that data point. Let me tell you, the answer should be yes, and here's why. We can update the recovery environment with an updated Windows Defender engine. So why wouldn't we also update the signatures? I'm going to give myself an escape hatch and say I'm not sure still, but it should be technically possible. I'll need to follow up and find out if we do that. What I can say is at a minimum, I know we have the networking stack loaded so that when you boot in the recovery environment, we can get to Windows Update and get the signatures. Whether they're there already, I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, I'll need to follow up. I just don't have an answer. But that's a really great question. I should have asked that myself when I was planning for this. All right, let's see. That covers about everything there. Let's go ahead and move into our last area. This feature is awesome. If there's three big features in the product, here's the third one, right? We have next generation credential, two-factor auth, we have enterprise data protection, and then we have this one, enterprise lockdown. This is a really effective solution for eliminating malware on devices. And this is not a defense. This is an architectural solution, right? So it will be a strong mitigation. So something that you've enjoyed probably on your Windows Phone devices and your iOS devices is you probably have not experienced a lot of malware on them. And why is that? Well, that's because every app that you get on this device comes through a vetting process. The vendor is vetted, so we validate they're a legitimate vendor. They then get access to submit content to the store, and then their applications are vetted, so we actually look at their apps using automation and even actual manual inspection. Then they're made available to the store, and then they end up on this device. So that's basically the process for iOS devices and Windows Phone. And it's been effective, right? Most people couldn't name a single iOS malware instance. Well, maybe you guys could because you're savvy, because there has been malware on iOS and there has been on Windows Phone. But as a percentage, it's so low that most people are like, it's a non-issue, right? Compared to PCs and in Android when it's not locked down. So you're going to be able to do that on your PCs. Now, some of you who are savvy are going, well, you already did that. You did that with Windows RT. And you would be right. Yes, we did do that with RT, but we're doing this in a slightly better way for Windows Enterprise Edition. So we're going to lock down enterprise business class PCs just like RT. So we lock it down at the factory. UEFI can't be changed. Third-party operating systems can't start on this PC. So we lock it down. We lock down the set of signatures that will be enabled to start on a PC. So we'll have a list of signatures sitting in UEFI, and only applications that are signed using those signatures will be able to start. And so if you're familiar with RT, you're probably thinking, oh, well, that's not very good because I have third-party ISV apps and I have line-of-business apps, and none of those are signed, and so this doesn't do me anything. And lots of people nodding. Guess what? We have a solution for this. And the solution is a code signing process that will be made available to ISVs and you as a corporation. You will be able to sign all of your internal line of business apps. ISVs will be able to sign their own Win32 apps. If they sign them, we'll make them available in the Windows Store. So Windows Store isn't just about universal apps anymore. It's going to be about every single app can be acquired from the store as long as they sign it. Will be signed with this one Microsoft, it's signed with a signature that chains up to our CA, which is how we control it. So it's not just that it's signed by VeriSign, it's signed to a CA that we own, so we can trust these signatures. So it requires more than signing, it requires a very specific signature. So ISVs will be able to put their apps in the store. So let's imagine that you've got an application from an ISV, and the ISV is bankrupt. Or it's let's say you're using two versions of a product ago, right? And the ISV is, well, we're only signing newer versions. We want you to move to the next platform. Treat it as a line of business app. You can sign the ISV's application if they don't exist or if they're unwilling to sign their own binaries. So now you can create a trusted app ecosystem on your devices, and I think that we can probably say that assuming our store process security is good and assuming that the person who owns signing line of business applications is trustworthy or doesn't lose control of the identity that they use to get binaries signed, I think we can say we can all but eliminate malware on these devices. So to be really clear, it requires a device that's configured by the OEM for lockdown. So you can't take your existing devices and do this, because if you can configure it to be locked down, malware can unconfigure it to deploy malware. So we want to make sure these are locked down in an irreversible way, which is why it has the OEM requirement. Which devices will run this technology? We're still working out. Will it be every business class device? Will it only be the most expensive ones? I'm not really sure. My request to the OEMs, we had a forum last 2 weeks ago called Ecosystem Forum. My recommendation to them was make every single one of your business class devices optional to be configured in this way, and I hope that they take our recommendation. We'll see what they decide to do. This was the first question, and then we'll move to you, and then you.
What will someone need to be able to lock their own stuff? Is this thing going to charge for them?
No. Well, there's the monetization at the OEM, so they're going to charge a little. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. So the question is, are there any fees related to the signing service, or how does it cost me? Yeah. So let me tell you. So the OEM will charge a premium, hopefully small. That was my recommendation, but we'll see what they listen to. They will charge the device. So imagine if they have two devices, one's going to be a little bit more expensive than the other. So that's the first place of monetization. The second place of monetization is the Enterprise Edition. So to run this, you have to be running Enterprise Edition of Windows. Access to the Enterprise Edition gives you access to the code signing service. And ISVs have access to the code signing service. So the only place you pay is on the device or with the Enterprise Edition. There's no other fees anywhere in the pipeline.
Will there be a way for us just in a test mode to create them? You know, those of us who like deploying our own systems would like to be able to say, well, we recognize that it's, you know, it's not the whole thing. Mm-hmm. We can get the experience of what it works like.
Is that the question? Yeah, so the question is, like, how do I set up a test environment so I can do this? That's a good question. So it's possible we could have a concept of test signatures where you could test sign bits. I'm not sure what our solution is at this point, so I'll have to take that back. We'll get an answer to that question at a minimum early in the year next year. To be honest, just this is something I should have mentioned is this is the earliest we've ever talked about the product ever. So a lot of the stuff I'm talking about is not built. Like, in fact, everything I've talked about is probably plumbing with maybe a little bit of API surface. I don't think you can experience any of these things I've talked about in the M1 build, which is the current technical preview. And technical preview 2, which we will do next year, you'll start to be able to use some of these things. And then there will probably be another edition where everything is lit up. So we're real early, so there's some answers we just don't have. So next question was right there.
In this version, in the plumbing, as you mentioned it, you have, of course, disabled or removed Windows Defender?
We have not removed Windows Defender. So it
should be no more need for it.
Oh, with this. Oh, so I misunderstood the question. So the question is, when I have this solution, do I need Windows Defender? Not as much as you used to, is the answer. But here's where a scenario I think it is good. So what I've been talking about for the last year in relationship to iOS, a lot of people say, well, you know, how come iOS and Windows Phone don't have, you know, an anti-malware solution? And my opinion is probably they should, and not for applications malware, but for documents. So documents that have active content in them, in theory, could run an exploit. Now, the good news is on Windows Phone and iOS, they're sitting in a container in a sandbox, so damage would be very limited. But imagine if you used your phone to move that infected document to somebody who was running Windows 7, right? So they can become a carrier. So anyway, so we are keeping Windows Defender in this edition. I think its usefulness is much diminished, but it may be able to deal with active content and documents and not in applications we've got covered. Yeah, next question. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Any ideas around the USB firmware attack thing? Is there anything going on?
Yeah. I'm going to put you on pause 1 sec. This actually is the end of the presentation, so I'm just going to skip to the end, and then you guys will get access to... Oops. Hopefully you liked this session. I'm baiting you to give me good reviews. For those of you who are wondering, where are the demos? I think I answered that earlier. All it is plumbing. There's nothing to show, hardly at all. But at any rate, so the question was related to firmware attacks on like USB devices. So a couple months ago, there was an article about this being the new threat vector. And the reality is there's just not a good solution for this. So this is kind of a scary thing. It's not being done at mass scale, but it's definitely something we're thinking about. And so when I saw that article, I instantly contacted my engineering counterpart, Scott, and said, who owns UEFI Secure Boot? I was like, we've got to have this concept of like a secure device boot, you know, because it's not boot, but it's secure attach. I don't know. We call it. We'll come up with some name. And he's like, yeah, this is something we're thinking about. We just haven't seen enough of the threat manifesting itself outside of black hat discussions that we just haven't prioritized it. So I think that's something we're going to have to get to one day. This leads to a solution, though, that's a little different, but it's related to BitLocker. There's a BitLocker session here. It's related to MBAM, so I encourage you to go to that. But something that they probably won't talk about there is something we're doing Windows 10 related to pre-boot authentication. And so we've worked very hard to eliminate the need for human interaction in the authentication process when a PC boots. So when a PC boots with McAfee or even BitLocker, you enter in a PIN or you enter in a password to unlock the volume, right? And so that just gets in the way. It prevents my PC from being manageable, and the PC has to turn off. It's a terrible experience, but maybe necessary. Well, most devices that we have today don't have a lot of the risk factors that necessitate the need for a user to be human, you know, present in typing in this PIN and password. We can actually say that you can boot the PC in many circumstances, and the keys for encryption won't be accessible in memory. And this is a long topic. It's like a half-hour topic in its own right. But the point, to bring it back to what you're talking about, is with FireWire, FireWire has direct memory access. And so so does FireWire, but FireWire is kind of gone. So what happens if somebody connects a FireWire device and gets system access to memory and the BitLocker key or the semantic key sitting in memory, then I can go get it. Well, a feature that we've added to Windows 10 that will work on Windows 8 certified devices and greater is that newly attached Thunderbolt device will not get any access to the system until the user signs in, which means that I can't walk to your PC when you're not there, plug in my PC, hijack your keys, because my device can't access your PC until you sign in. So it's related to your topic, but it's loose, but I wanted to talk about the feature because I think it's really cool. All right, so there was a next question was here.
Yes, does it work with custom images? If I build a custom image and sysprep it, can I use Enterprise Lockdown then?
So the question is if the image is sysprepped, is it related to the Enterprise Lockdown? Can I sysprep an image and lay it down with Enterprise and get that feature to work?
Yes.
The answer is absolutely yes. In fact, everybody in this audience should go to Michael Niehaus's sessions about deploying Windows. A great feature that we have is if you get a brand new PC from an OEM that's running professional and you want to go to Enterprise, what do you do today? Wipe the disk, create a gold image, and you have all this labor involved. You can transform Pro into Enterprise without deploying any new software because Enterprise is in Pro, and your management system will turn a Pro box into Enterprise with a switch, basically. So that will allow you to go from a PC with lockdown enabled by the OEM with Pro on it, and then Pro lockdown occurs when you transform it to Enterprise automatically, or you sysprep it. It's all good. Yeah. All good. Yeah. But if you're running Pro on this device, that feature doesn't work. You need to upgrade it to Enterprise, and then Enterprise then has the ability to prevent unsigned or non-trusted signatures from starting up on the PC. There's a question right there.
Do you need to set up a cloud service for the next-gen credentials like Azure Active Directory, or can you implement it without cloud services?
Boy, I had a hard time hearing this. It's very echoey in here, so sometimes I have difficulty hearing.
If you want to implement the next-gen credentials, mm-hmm. do you have to set up a cloud service like Azure Active Directory, or can you do it with your own resources?
Yeah, so the question is, if I want to use next-generation credentials, what do I need to set it up? Do I need Azure Active Directory or whatnot? So the answer is, it depends on what you want to do. So let's talk about a couple different scenarios. So if I want to use a next-generation credential on-prem with Active Directory, we're still working on the exact story there. You may need to deploy one or more Windows 10 aligned server roles with the Active Directory server role enabled to enable this to work. Our goal is to make it really easy. We don't want you to have to rebuild the infrastructure to support this. So hopefully one server is enough, but it depends on your topology, right? So if you have multiple forests and these things, then maybe it's more than one. So that's scenario one. If you want to support log on to a PC with Azure Active Directory, which is a new feature in Windows 10, then Azure Active Directory has everything behind the scenes to enable that to work. So it just works automatically. If I'm using Microsoft accounts, something I forgot to mention, Microsoft accounts on Windows 10 will always be two-factor. So under the hood, you'll automatically get next-generation credential and we'll put you in that mode. And you don't have to do anything. So the only scenario where you have to really think about it is the on-prem scenario. Or a hybrid scenario. We're using Azure Active Directory and AD on-prem. Question, actually, that was the next one, and then we'll move to you. And yeah.
Thank you. You mentioned quite a lot about the data loss prevention and the ability to classify data as either personal or corporate and that sort of thing. Are we going to have to wait until we've rolled out the entire enterprise to Windows 10 before we can take advantage of that? Or in the way that, for example, you said on iOS, your versions of Office there will support it, will there be any sort of service pack or upgrade to older versions of Office on Windows 7 to allow us to at least take some advantage of that?
Gotcha. Yeah, so this is a great question because the devil is in the details on this one, as we say. And so so the question is related to, like, what do I really need to make enterprise data protection go? Do I need every PC running this or not? And so the answer is, you have to figure out, I haven't thought about this question, but you don't have to roll everybody to Windows 10. What will happen is Windows 10 devices will have... The content will be protected. The Windows 7 devices won't be able to protect that content coming in. When I share content from a Windows 10 device to a Windows 7 device on-prem, I'm trying to think what will happen there. That's an interesting scenario. I need to find out, actually. I think it's possible that they might not have access to that content. So this is something I'm actually going to have to go back to the engineering team and find out what we do there. When we transition content from Windows 7. We have to have a situation where we have to support multiple platforms. I just don't know what the interop story is, because if it requires everybody to move to Windows 10 before it ever can work, it becomes, I think, a non-starter. I don't want to make any bad assumptions on how it works.
I mean, I'm primarily interested in Office documents. So yeah. I'd be very interested if the Office team were going to release, say, an Office 25 okay. service.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So if we're just concerned about the Office side of the story, right, as we talked about, some apps will need to be enlightened in order to maintain protection. It will require a new edition of Office. So existing editions, Office 10 and everything, anything prior to the new edition coming out, will not be able to preserve the content. So you will need to move to a new version of Office to take advantage of the enterprise data protection feature. There will be two versions of it. There will be a touch first edition, and there will be a traditional desktop version, because we, of course, need a version of Office that works on the desktop for Windows 7, et cetera. So yeah, requires a new version of Office. Good question. Any other? I kind of lost track. There's one over here. Yes.
About controllability, like, do I depend on the OEM to deploy my own lockdown system? And even, can I deploy my own TPM?
Can you deploy your own TPM? So the first question, the answer is related to, can I deploy my own image to my own PC when I'm getting these OEM lockdown PCs? The answer is yes. You can either use the image that's on there, which is professional, transform it to enterprise using management, or you can wipe it down clean and put your own custom image for that. The second question was related to the TPM. Can you restate?
About TPM. Like, I can deploy my own certificates and TPM, my own keys for things to load while I'm booting.
Uh-huh. Okay, so but I need a little bit more of the scenario. So is it related to enterprise lockdown, or is it just TPM questions in isolation?
Enterprise lockdown.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, yeah. So it changes nothing when it comes to TPM. Enterprise lockdown does not change anything about how you manage, interact with the TPM at all. It has actually no connection with it, because UEFI is actually doing all of the work for us.
System, like the Microsoft OS, accessing the TPM for me. I just
want
to control TPM.
You want to control? So just make sure I understand. So you want to create a condition where you're using third-party technology to deal with the TPM completely, which means not using BitLocker, not using any... Okay, so you can do that, but you won't be able to, for instance... You would be saying, I'm not going to use NGC. NGC is going to use the TPM through Windows in our own management. And so you're saying no to a lot of Windows. Any feature that Windows uses the TPM for, you're saying no to that if you want to manage the TPM outside of Windows. I know there are scenarios, particularly in defense, where they're looking in that. I'm not sure what industry you're in, but that's we probably want to have a longer conversation about why you want to do that. But anyway, it's a good question, yeah, nonetheless. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah.
Is it linked to the Kubernetes, not to the application layer? It's linked to the OS layer. Just
yeah.
To follow up, I mean, what we're saying about whether, let's say, Office would help or not help. Is it linked to an application layer or linked to an OS layer?
Yeah. So the question is next generation credentials got any? Is it have to do with applications specifically, or is it just like the identity we're using today, username and password, smart cards, or all the other options? It's a system level functionality. Has no dependency on apps, and well-designed apps can inherently take advantage of it. One place where you could run into trouble with next-generation credential is if you have line-of-business applications that force the user to type in a username and password, which is a bad idea, in my view, and you're not using Windows to prompt for a password, then you could run into a situation where that app might not work. That should be a very small percentage of the apps out there, but that's a, you know, I didn't design all the apps out there, so it's possible you'll run into a few challenges there. But under normal circumstances, every app should be able to take advantage of this unless they've done something that is not best practices in its design.
Well, the enterprise lockdown, the code signing, where does it take place? Is it on a system we own, or do we have to transfer it to a Microsoft system? And for the signatures, can we use signatures which are based on our own CA, or do we have to base it on a Microsoft CA?
It has to be based on a. So the question is, you know, what's the story with this service we're providing? How does it work? You know, where's the data? So when it comes to signatures, it has to come from RCA, and that's how we make sure that a bad guy can't sign something and put it on your PC. So we want to make sure that we have a chain of trust in the signatures. So then the second part of the question was related to where are the bits signed?
Yeah.
That's actually, I'm not really sure how that service, it's actually being developed right now. So I'm not sure, yeah, on that one. So early next year, we'll have an answer to that one. Yeah.
The enterprise feature is realized by some hardware-related bit in BIOS or...
So the question is, what's the root of trust for enterprise lockdown? And the answer is UEFI. So UEFI has a data store where we can list signatures, and we put the signatures that Windows will trust in there and nothing else. And that's what that's what the hypervisor code integrity feature in the VSM is able to determine, hey, are these signatures that are in the UEFI database? If the answer is yes, we allow them to fire up. If the answer is no, access denied.
Switch a machine from an enterprise lockdown mode to a non-enterprise lockdown, just if you need to.
So the question is, can I take an enterprise lockdown mode device? Could a firmware with new signatures come to the device and maybe compromise the security of the feature?
Yeah, or just change it?
Yeah, so the answer is no. Well, assuming somebody doesn't make a mistake in the process. But so these devices that are locked down by the OEM, unlike your Windows 8.1 devices where you have access to the UEFI data store and you can put any signatures in there that you want, this is locked down. You can't change its... The OEM can. The OEM could... Yeah, the OEM could make a mistake, potentially. It's locked down in a way where only the OEM can update it. So as long as the OEM doesn't screw up the data store... that is going to be pretty darn secure. But there is a risk at the OEM level.
It could be also for some good reason the case you want to switch a machine from an enterprise lockdown, cause repurpose, whatever, to a non-enterprise lockdown machine.
Yeah, so the question is, if I have an enterprise lockdown PC from the OEM, can I undo it and run it like a traditional PC and do what I want? The answer right now is no. Yeah, so it's possible that we're still in development and we're listening to a lot of feedback on this very issue. But I think that's the intent today. So does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Question. I need to go.
I just want to know, why do I need the OEM to lock down the PC? You said because everything I configure as an administrator can be undone
by
maybe the malware person. That I understand. But for example, in many phones right now at the market, there are like something like soft fuses. So I could deploy maybe an image and I write, let's say, some signature to a chip. But this signature matches my image signature. And then the fuses, the soft fuse will be blown and I can never change the signature. And so I have a secure boot. And so I don't need an OEM for that. I don't know if you understand exactly what I mean.
Well, I kind of have the gist of it. I'm not familiar with that approach, but...
So you're
saying somebody could bypass this?
No.
Or are you saying...
What you can do by now that is nothing very uncommon, you could trigger by software that a fuse on your motherboard, on your mainboard blows.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then this connection is broken. I mean, maybe you could write... For example, to a flash chip, and then you could blow up the hardware fuse, and so the flash chip can't be written to anymore. So then it's read only.
Yeah.
And in such a way, you could do your own lockdown. You don't need an OEM for you to do this. You could trigger this.
Yeah.
Then it would be as safe because you couldn't change it either. Because if the fuse is blown, then there's no way.
I understand. I understand. So yes, I think there is no reason technically.
Yeah,
why you can't put your own devices even to, well, if you had Windows 10 when this feature ends up in the build, you had an 8.1 device, yes, technically you could put it in this state. We're not going to be supporting that at the moment. But I think, yes, theoretically it could be done securely. It would require a high level of sophistication. But, you know, everything can be docked and made easy. So.
The thing is because I'm saying this because then you would be in complete control how to really lock down your PC to your needs, and nothing is going outside your enterprise.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I understand.
If you're really talking about, okay, this is for high security things, like maybe accessing human resources data or whatever, or medical data, then this could be a very useful need for such enterprise lockdown things. But if I have no control of, let's say, signing or whatever.
Yeah.
Because I have to give it to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
so the chain of trust is a little let's say disrupted.
No, I completely understand the comment and the feedback, and it's something I can take back to the engineering team. I mean, I think you have valid points. Our intent, though, in the moment is like the chain of trust is going to be your own OEM.
Of course, the OEM would still need to implement something like these. One-way street, let's put it that way, so you can use it.
Yes.
Of course, you would still need an OEM hardware supplier to implement this feature, but you would be in control.
Yeah. Well, I'll take it as feedback, and you know, like I said, there's a lot of features are still evolving, and so they're not all locked, but I want to be real clear about our intent, and then in a way, I'm pushing this intent to you so you can push back to me so I can give feedback for engineering, so I'll bring that back. And then I'm going to take the last couple questions outside because I'm getting kicked, and so I'll meet you out there in the hallway in a moment.